Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined by Matt Graham.
Good morning, or evening.
Firstly, I should say congratulations for your AFI nomination.
Thank you very much. It's very exciting.
Yeah, nice getting nominations for things, isn't it?
Yeah. Kind of scary getting photos taken of you and, you know, usually on the other side of the camera, but, you know, still fun.
Scarier if you win the darn thing. But let's discuss this week's film, which is Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Yes, we're going back and looking, and I'd like to say we're looking at Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's not quite that simple, actually, is it? There are actually multiple versions of Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm still afraid that there might be another one coming out one day, but I'm happy for just the three at the moment.
Well, the original version was, of course, the theatrical version. Then there was a special edition released, and the special edition did the controversial thing of showing us inside the mothership at the end. Now, you're probably too young to remember this, Matt, but I actually remember when that came out, and I so desperately wanted to see what happened in that mothership. I went and I sat through the whole thing just to see the bit at the end inside the mothership.
You see, I think I saw, I can't remember which one was the first one I saw. I don't remember seeing the inside the mothership the first time, so maybe I saw a theatrical version on TV or something when I was a kid.
And then after that was the director's cut. Director's cut actually removed going inside the mothership, because Steven Spielberg himself has said that he thought it was a mistake to show what happened inside the mothership. So that's impossible to see. Now, there is actually a new DVD, or relatively new DVD, that's come out, the 30th anniversary edition of Close Encounters, which comes out actually on Blu-ray and on normal DVD, and has, I think, all the versions of it. And it's also possible to download it from iTunes. So the version from iTunes does not include going inside the mothership.
Excellent. So maybe that's the anniversary edition, I guess.
So the director's cut. So I guess let's start with a general thing before we get into the visual effects. Did you enjoy the film?
I did. It was nice going back and watching it again and, you know, having a big long think about it. Because obviously when you see these films as a kid, you're like, awesome. And then, but later on, as your technical knowledge grows, so you, I guess you appreciate these films for, you know, what advances they really made back then.
Absolutely. I guess for me, I held this film in fairly high regard because I was at that impressionable age when it came out. I thought it was just awesome. And I had no idea how they did it. And I must say, there are aspects of this film that to this day I think are just incredibly well done. And I wouldn't imagine one would be able to significantly improve upon. But I guess the thing that I'm struck with is just how few actual visual effect shots there are in a film that's all about aliens. And
definitely. I mean, the simplicity of it all, it's what you can do with some light bulbs and a smoke machine. And the effect that you can create, and but that's the, I guess that's why he really wanted to remove the inside of the mothership for his director's version, because it's the suspense of not actually seeing and just, you know, the hint of mystery and mayhem outside the windows with the lights and smoke.
Yeah, I mean, it really is for me that shot when he's stopped at the railway crossing and the lights come up behind him and he waves the first car around and
yeah,
the lights
come
up behind him
that.
And it goes over the top of him. And I'm like, that was it. That was the moment that I was just completely hook, line and sinkered.
It's a perfect pantomime moment of, it's behind you.
Yeah, I've got to say though, the kid being abducted was pretty scary when I first saw it. The now probably one of the most iconic shots of all time of him opening the door with the streaming lights. And
I wonder who was the first person to use a kid in a kind of thrilling moment. It was, because, you know, that seems to be the major ingredient. Insert smiley happy kid that doesn't know what's about to happen.
There did seem a lot of innocence. Sort of poltergeisty type shots similar around that time. They're back.
Yep.
But hey, let's not take anything away from this. So this is obviously a hugely successful film, made possible, I guess, by the success that Spielberg had coming off Jaws, though the actual whole film really derives its story and plot points from an earlier Spielberg effort that he started really early on, actually, almost as a kid, and then it became Firelight, and then from Firelight became something like...
It did have another name.
Watch the Stars. I'm going to get that in a second. Watching the Stars, something like that. And then, of course, became Close Encounters
Of the Third Kind.
Of the Third Kind, yeah. Not one, not two, not three.
He actually says in one of the extra scenes on the DVD that, you know, that was the biggest problem and difficulty of making the film, trying to get the marketing department to go with that title, because no one quite understood. Why is it Of the Third Kind? This is a weird name. Can't you just have a one-word name? It's like,
yeah, because today it'd be Alien. Except they already had that one, of course. The other thing that's kind of interesting to me, just as a film buff, is that it had François Truffaut in it as the French director's only occasion to act in somebody else's film. And his interviews, in particular with Hitchcock, while Hitchcock was still alive, were just the stuff of legend. So anyway, it was incredible, talented cast. And I don't know if you picked this up, but the guy who was the interpreter, did you pick up? He was the guy who was the NBC executive in Seinfeld.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
I knew I'd seen him before.
And he was also
somewhere.
In Gosford Park, and I loved him in Gosford Park. So
from the sounds of things in the extra interview, he sounds like he's doing an awful lot of producing these days as well.
Yeah, and directing. I think it's Bob Balaban is his name. Great actor. So let's start with how some of the shots were done. And before we get up to the killer stuff, like the end sequence, I was sitting there watching it. And, of course, one of the problems, I guess, of watching this today is you can't help but consider how you might do it yourself if you were presented with this problem today as opposed to when they did it back then. And I was – first time that kind of struck me was in the desert sequence when they came across the ship or the boat stranded in the desert. And I couldn't help but ponder how I might tackle that today if that was actually something that came up in the script. Did you have the same kind of –
Definitely. I mean, you could see that it was a classic forced perspective shot. And obviously, this was actually shot once he got the extra money for the special edition, because, it was one of the shots that wasn't in the cinematic release. But he managed to get some money, go out and shoot some more stuff, on the proviso that he showed inside the mothership. So I think it's a great shot. Extends that original intro part. And it's a classic. It's easily done. And if you were to approach it any other way than that they did today, you'd be just, finding a long way around.
It'd be CG if it was done today. Back, as you say then, being a forced perspective miniature is just classic.
Would you do it the CG now?
Yeah, totally. And I'll tell you why you do it today, because the shot wouldn't be the shot they had. There's a lack of discipline on camera work, because the concept would be we don't want to limit the director anyway creatively. So that shot would be a helicopter shot, point of view coming over a sand dune, then seeing it swinging around it and then landing, and the guys then coming out. It would be like,
so more coverage, basically.
More coverage from different angles. Look at us, aren't we clever? It would be the ship stranded in Pirates of the Caribbean, where the guy ropes it down onto the, and that's exactly how they did it in Pirates. They did a sort of scaffold rig on set and then put a ship in digitally and did a brilliant job.
I suppose I'm thinking of it with my indie hat on of, like, how could I do this nice, easy and cheap?
Oh, you mean indie as in independent filmmaker?
Yep.
I was going to think Indiana Jones. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, if you wanted to do it independently, indie-wise, I definitely think you could go for the same technique and it would work as well. I mean, I just think it looks really, really good.
Sells a shot.
Yeah, it doesn't look fake. And there are many composited 3D kind of models that do look fake, so it was terrific. And as you said, a lot of the stuff isn't that explicit. A lot of it is just heavy-duty use of lights and smoke machines. And interestingly, they really did pummel the lighting guys on this film. I mean, so much so that I think they were pulling out lights. I'm going to check this, but I think it was like Panavision that were providing the lights. Anyway, whoever was providing the lights, they were literally pulling lights out that they'd kind of retired to get, every last ounce of it out and sort of whacked in there to make it work. And I think, it's an enormous amount of latitude or light level differences between what they were getting to light up the scenes to film them at night and then what they were getting for those extreme shots of, like, the light coming down on the road in front and stuff. It must have been one hell of a power grid problem back then to pull it down. But look, it worked. I mean, you didn't need to see the ships. Yes, there were a couple of occasions when it was a bit weird, like shadows going over the fields for a light-emitting spaceship.
Yeah, again, I think that was a shot that they added on later on. That was once he got a bit more money, he added that one when he could. So I don't know. I think that one might have been done digitally.
Oh, really?
Replacing a different shot that was in there.
We actually have a cheat's guide to Close Encounters, which is actually something that comes with the special edition DVD. It's a poster. On the back of the poster, it actually has the original version of the special edition and the director's cut as timeline, kind of what's in and what's out. I can't see that shot you're talking about, but I take your word for it.
Yeah, I think that's just something they mentioned on one of the extra bits of the DVD, which I really enjoy the extra bits of the DVD. If anyone gets this box set, I highly recommend going to those parts, although I was disappointed that there wasn't enough commentaries for my liking.
Yeah. I thought what was really interesting is that the mothership, let's just move our attention now to the mothership for a second.
Yep.
The mothership was originally going to be pretty much a big kind of hulking dark thing. And they were actually filming in India, and Spielberg drove past a large oil refinery at night. And if you've been past an oil refinery at night, you'll know that it's got tons of lights. But not only that, of course, it had lots of pipes and outcroppings and things. And he looked at it and he thought, well, that would look really cool. And so it was the model that was built was based on this idea of a very brightly lit, tons of tubes and sort of things. And I think it gave it this great sense of looking original, because back then, of course, our idea of what a spaceship should look like was much more sort of
big
Flash
disc.
Gordon,
yeah,
big disc, as opposed to something that would have aerodynamic problems because of lots of antennary type lines. The fact that it broke the laws of aerodynamics was a brilliant design.
And gave it a more organic feel as well. Just the interaction of the pipes and welding and all that kind of stuff. And I think the lights underneath were inspired by looking down, I think, the San Fernando Valley or something like that, to give it that kind of illuminated, magical feel.
I said a moment ago it was Panavision. I actually meant Technicolor. There were lights they brought out from the Technicolor era that were in mothballs to get the kind of lighting levels that they needed. But, you know, this film holds the record for the most cinematographers on a production. They had 11, if you count the special edition, 11 DOPs working on this.
Wow.
So, huge amount of stuff. But the person that really, from our point of view, now moving to the visual effects, gets all the attention is Douglas Trumbull, who really did an insanely great job on this film. So I think the budget for the visual effects stuff was about, what, $3 million, is that right?
I'm not privy to those numbers myself.
You're not privy to
it. I imagine that would be a good sizable amount for back in the day.
Yeah, I remember when the film came out that he joked that in fact they could make an entire film for just what the visual effects budget of this one was, and quite frankly, do we care? Not really, because it was magnificent.
Definitely.
And one of the things that we actually heard about when we were interviewing Scott Squires, who was starting his career on this film, later go on to do such great things as Star Wars and Dragonheart and stuff. He was telling us when we were interviewing him for the FX Guide TV stuff about how they were pouring milk or cream into coffee, and like, oh, that looks like a cloud. And it was on the basis of that they set out to work out how to make cloud tanks. And this film really nailed it for the first time we saw cloud tanks at the sort of level that we did. And that shot around the end where the clouds are coming around the side of the Devil's Peak, yeah.
That's awesome shot.
And, you know, it looks really, really good.
Look, I've seen cloud tanks now, but I can only imagine what it'd be like to see, you know, that shot for the first time going, wow, just hold your seat kind of stuff. How the hell did they do that?
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of stuff in there, obviously, with the spaceships and the lack of being able to do stuff digitally. But I think the advances in doing that cloud tank stuff was just sensational and produced such a great organic and brilliant kind of look that really, really just separated the film out and gave it an entire new level that we sort of really hadn't seen before.
Yep.
Interestingly, the film was shot anamorphically, which I think is shows, because there's quite a lot of glares and highlights that have a really anamorphic kind of lens feel to them. But to cope with shooting the anamorphic stuff and compositing it with the stuff that would obviously have to go through optical printers and therefore have step downs, the visual effects team shot in 70mm. So basically they shot 70mm so that when they did their various optical compositing, they could then come out with a 35mm print that would look as clean and as correct as did the rest of the 35mm shot anamorphically. And that's pretty significant, because otherwise we would have had this huge telltale sign that we had visual effects shots coming up, because they would have suddenly got grainier and less contrasty and just looked different. And I think that the effect shots actually mapped in really, really well to the non-effect shots. It just didn't telegraph, here comes the effect shot.
The only time that I really felt that was, I guess, the road when we first kind of see the aliens, spaceships fly over up on the hill. You feel like it's in a set, but that's nothing to do with,
I agree with that,
the effect shots working into that. And obviously, they needed to do that. They actually had two sound stages joined together so the car could actually get to the right speed to come around that corner.
Wow.
But yeah, obviously, they needed to have more control, especially with a child actor in the middle there. But you know, otherwise, I think everything is pretty seamless.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it that it did look like a bit of a studio environment for that. Point on the corner of the road. But having said that, and obviously the other thing, I guess, is to be honest, the compositing of the spaceships in that same sequence there, like they didn't have the clarity and sort of contrast range in the comps of the actual ships. There was lots of glows and stuff, so it looked nice, but they still looked a little kind of...
So they used multiple passes, just a very slow motion control to get all that spaceship flying and different lighting effects coming off them, blurs and trails and just hearing about that kind of stuff was really intriguing. It must have taken days to get all those bits and pieces together, but then, you know, if we do it these days, take days to render them out.
Yeah, that's true. I thought that was really good. I mean, the actual mothership itself, the giant spaceship that we really build to at the end, which, by the way, I did like it from a directorial point of view, that, you know, they came down, they did their thing, including the little Peter Panny kind of Tinkerbell one at the end, which I'll come back to in a sec. But and then they were like, well, that's it, it's all over. And they all shook hands and everyone was like, yay, what an amazing experience we are. And Binder's like, wait a second, you ain't seen nothing yet. And that was a really, I mean, that's why Spielberg became so, he knew an audience well enough to know that they would enjoy those kind of build-ups, release, build-up again. It just gave the second impact so much more.
Yeah, great storytelling.
Punch, yeah. If only he'd done that with Indiana Jones 4. But anyway.
And several other things. Anyway.
But the big UFO landing set was 27 metres high, 137 metres long and 76 metres wide, making it the largest indoor film set that had at that point ever been constructed. And it was enormous. I mean, it had 6.4 kilometres of scaffolding and 1,570 square metres of fiberglass. Just an amazing amount of stuff.
Wow.
And you know what? The actual UFO miniatures, the ones that that they were, you know, filming, the ones they did in the, obviously, the dark rooms, the 9-foot model of the mothership actually was locked up in Steven Spielberg's garage because they were so worried about leaks getting out to the press in advance.
Oh, wow.
That the only safe place to put it back then, because obviously they didn't have the kind of level of control they have today, was they just literally hid it in Spielberg's garage until the thing. I thought it was just so well done, that end ship, the thing coming down. But a moment ago I mentioned the Peter Pan Tinkerbell thing. I had not really locked on to the When You Wish Upon a Star, Pinocchio kind of theme that was going on when I watched it the first time. And this time I became really aware of it, both with, you know, that little toy on the desk when he's just building the model of the... he's trying to determine what he's building in his house.
Back when he's doing the mashed potato pile-up?
Yeah, just after that. And he does the thing in his living room.
Yep.
And there's a shot that comes across and he lifts a piece of paper up and there's a little toy that starts playing Wish Upon a Star.
Yep.
And apparently this whole Wish Upon a Star thing was a massive theme that he was stopped from incorporating due to Disney constraints in the first pass because they didn't have rights to doing it. But I believe in the second past they then got the rights, and it was this whole sort of link into this Disney Wish Upon a Star stuff that also I think affected that Tinkerbell last little spaceship that comes through late after all of them, you know, the main lot comes through and the little one comes through as a little thing. And apparently that song was incorporated into the John Williams score, and so it became something that he sort of built into it as a concept in the second and third releases of the film, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, earlier on he does try to get the kids to not go to crazy golf and go see Pinocchio.
Pinocchio, so exactly, that's part of it, yeah. And so there's a sort of sub-recurring theme that goes all the way through it.
I thought it was also interesting, earlier in the film you see these cutaway shots of like a McDonald's sign and a Chevron dealership kind of sign as they're driving around. And I thought, they kind of seem out of place, but... That was actually, those signs, the neon signs, were the basis of some of the looks, again, for the smaller spaceships. They actually made a spaceship that kind of looked like the Golden Arches.
And oh, really?
Again, kind of like the Chevron logo. So it's this kind of back referencing and forward referencing.
That's interesting to know that. Yeah. I know that there was a model of R2-D2 that actually appeared
that
in the bottom
of the... That was a classic
one. Though I couldn't find it. I looked for it. I mean, actually stop-framed looked for it, but I couldn't find it. Somebody knows where that is, they can post it to us, because I'd love to see that. Did you just think it was funny? Because every once in a while they'd come across a piece of technology, like they'd suddenly, something awesome was happening and the news crew would turn up with a film camera.
Yep.
And it was just like, oh, we want to play back the sound from the desert that they were chanting, and the guy has a reel-to-reel machine that he's playing. It was just terrific little snapshots of technology that you sort of didn't expect.
I love those. I'm hoping someone's going to make another throwback film that's going to use these kind of techniques and also keep these old school technologies in it, because it looks far more interesting to see a reel-to-reel around someone's shoulder than, you know, a tiny little iPod recorder.
I must admit that the whole old school restriction on being able to do stuff, which of course was so successful in Jaws when they... Shark wouldn't work. You know, that those screws unscrewing themselves on the floor when the light's coming. I mean, how simple is that, and how effective is it as the screws unscrew and fall?
That's a great shot. That was they actually did pick that. They used to, did that as a pickup. The
oh, really?
Editor was cutting away, and they needed something to add to the scene. So that was one of the pickup shots they did after principal filming for the original version.
Oh, cool.
That and also the POV of the alien coming down the fireplace. Originally, there was just a shot of, you know, the mother waving her arm underneath the fireplace, and then to reach the closing mechanism. But then they thought, you know what, this scene needs some more grunt, so they shot that POV, that great POV coming down the chimney.
I mean, the advances in motion control photography, the advances in model making, and the of course the cloud tank stuff we already discussed is just spectacular. But I got to say, at that point in the film, I didn't think we were ever going to see the aliens. I didn't think that, you know, when I remember watching it, I just thought, oh, they're never going to show us the aliens. It's always going to be the POV of the kind of unseen...
The ships, maybe a couple of silhouettes if you're lucky.
How did you think the aliens actually looked when they came out of the ship?
I liked them. I mean, the alien at the very end that you actually get to see is my favourite.
Right.
And, you know, very E.T.-esque.
Well, it's now the sort of default alien for all subculture, isn't it?
It is.
You know, if you want an alien, that's the one you reference.
If you drive down Main Street of Roswell, actually, all the lamps have a similar kind of head with little alien eyes painted on the top.
If you want to get alien beef jerky.
Or alien beer.
Tell you something pretty funny I found out in doing some research. You know the early air traffic controller scene when they're doing the air traffic controlling and they, you know... What, do you want to report an incident?
Yep.
Nope. So apparently this dude turns up to set up the instruments for that, right? And he actually turns up on set to set all this stuff up. And they were like, oh, this guy's just the sort of boffin we want. So he actually got stuffed in the film. I think his name was Philip Dodds. He made his acting, and I think his only acting appearance in his entire life as
That's
the...
a shame.
But there were real air traffic controllers in that scene that they were using. But this one guy who came in to do the you know... I think it was ARP Instruments set up this kind of, you know, thing for doing the stuff, and he set up his ARP 2500, and they were like, yeah, you should do exactly that because you know what you're doing.
Some of the composition of those shots was awesome. It just really built that tension. And I love the screens, like, you know, actual screens, not CG replaced monitors. I thought that was great.
That, and did you notice there was some amazing depth of field in that shot?
Yeah.
I mean, for a shot that was almost nothing, as you say, the composition was good, the monitor stuff was good, but also I was looking at it and there was a shot where they had like about half an inch of depth of field. The guy in the middle of the shot was in, people in front and behind him were out.
Yep.
It was just magnificent. And of course, you know, really has a cinematic feel. That shot without such depth of field wouldn't have looked anywhere near as cinematic, but it really nailed it.
That definitely stood out a lot, that scene, because of, you know, just, yeah, construction.
Did you actually find out what the musical notes were? That is the dun dun dun.
It does, yes.
It's like G A F
I cannot remember.
C or something. But if anyone knows what that is, I couldn't actually work out what the musical notes were. I'm not that musical enough to do that. If you can post and let us know, we'd really love to know what the actual musical combination. I sat there with my...
Yeah, Spielberg sat down with John Williams one afternoon and just went through 100 different combinations. And
I heard
they both kind of went, yeah, that one, that works.
Can you imagine sitting there going, what about this one? Nah, this one, nah.
After about 10 beers, maybe you're just getting a bit excited. Yeah, let's get this one.
Yeah, it's so definitively iconic now. I wonder I wonder at the time how quick, I mean, not how quickly, because they went through hundreds to get to it, but I mean, how much they were when they found it, they were like, yep, this is the one.
Yep.
Because today you can't imagine any other sound. And that idea of musical language through, you know, connecting
through
up.
Through maths.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was nice. And it's been used again since, of course, and films like Contact really nailed it in terms of a mathematical basis for a dialogue. But yeah, no, it was good. There was a lot of good concepts in this film. A couple of interesting errors we found in our research. Did you know that when they went to the ships, the planes that were found in the desert, you know, the
yep.
World War II fighter planes, they pull out a map from the, or like a calendar, sorry.
Yep.
And that calendar, you might be interested to know this. I know John Montgomery would be interested to hear this, has Helvetica typeface, which wasn't actually invented until 1954. But those were planes from 1945. So I'm sorry.
They went to outer space.
They just blew the credibility. It was the whole point. It was that they just popped them in there. Anyway, it's...
Again, that was another pickup shot, which they added, I think, for the special edition. Another thing they got to go out and film because they didn't have the budget. Originally supposed to be shot in the Amazon, but money was too tight, so it got canned and then later put in for the special edition.
Oh, really? So let's discuss the elephant in the room, the going inside the spaceship. Did you think it was a valid thing for him to do? Do you think it was an atrocity against filmmaking? Because this really led to that whole, like, there's a lineage between this and Lucas going back and changing who shoots first in the cantina.
Look, I like keeping things in my imagination. I don't want to see inside the dark door. I think it's far more menacing or intriguing not to see it, but actually have the viewers and the readers. It's like a book thing.
Okay, but the shot is there. The shot is there to go inside. You don't want to see it? I mean, no. You personally, Matt Graham, don't want to see inside the spaceship?
Nope.
I was busting my chomps to get and see inside the spaceship.
I guess... More often than not, when someone shows you inside the door, you get disappointed. Maybe it's just these days you do, but back in the day,
I agree. I think it's like a magic trick, right? Like I've begged people to show me magic tricks, and when they show them to me, you go, oh, I can see it now.
Yeah, then it's not so fun.
But before they show it to you, you would move heaven and earth to find out how they did it. Well, I must admit, I'm the same with this. I really wanted to see inside that tube.
Look, for what you did see, I did like, you know, the millions of little aliens peering down. Which were, again, all tiny, tiny miniatures shot moving very slowly with lights flickering behind them. I enjoyed what I did see, but I'd prefer to make it up.
Really? Well, I mean, I know that, it's something he obviously retracted doing because he removed it again. There was no doubt about it that that putting it in made a bunch of people, including myself, want to go and see it. I'm sure that it's the right decision not to see inside because it's the promise of what it would be. And also, once you see inside, it's so anticlimactic. Like, where do you go from there kind of thing? So
I'm a big fan of also, you know, once you make a film and it gets out there, move on. There's only so much you can do. And if you don't have another idea in your head, maybe sit down and have another think. I mean, I also get frustrated by, you know, every film being an alien film. But, if that's what he does and loves doing...
I do think that there's a certain... It's a bit like recolouring black and white films. Like, I know why people do it, because otherwise an audience won't watch them. By the same token, it feels like that is the snapshot in time.
Yeah.
And that's what you should go with. And it has its own place. And, you know, you can't really imagine someone going, well, you know, this Picasso, I think we could get better paint work if we used newer pigments. Let's go repaint it.
Like, do I need to see Star Wars in 3D? I think that's going to be the big question I'll be asking myself.
I have seen that. I have seen sections of Star Wars in 3D. You so want to do it.
Do I?
No, you do. Actually, it really looks cool.
I've seen it so many times now.
No.
Now, is it 3D version with all the new scenes in it, or is it 3D with...
In my case, I saw a scene, not I remember the most, was a scene actually from the second lot of three. So it was the last film's opening battle sequence in 3D.
See, that'd be fun.
But that was pretty cool. That was a nice... By the way, that was actually directed by Spielberg. He came along and said to Lucas, I wanted to direct something in Star Wars, my only chance. And he said, sure, why don't you just do this opening battle thing here? We know that because the guys over at Third Floor did the previews on it, and Spielberg was sending them Spielberg drawings, which are like stick figures that are almost incomprehensible, but in fact exactly what was ended up on film.
I guess for previews and things like that, you have to almost learn how to speak a second stick figure language on napkins.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? I mean, well, look, I think if you haven't seen this film in a while, definitely I'd recommend going and seeing it again. It is absolutely terrific. I think the pacing of it, we're just not used to this level of kind of build-up. I mean, these days the audience would have more given to them sooner. The opening sequence would be less.
And a lot more coverage.
Yeah, a lot more coverage. But I think it stacks up really, really well. It is a good film. It's maybe, to some of you, perhaps not as good as you remember it because, you know, at the time it was, let's face it, you know, the greatest film of all time kind of thing.
But yeah.
Probably slightly lower your expectations a little, but not in terms of the visual effects. I think that the guys that did the visual effects really set a bar, and it's actually kind of humiliating to see bad effects today and think, look what these guys did, you know, 30 years ago, and then today we're producing these kind of unrealistic sort of crap.
Yeah, I think these days we've now gotten back to that same benchmark which was set back then. Only now are we seeing films like Iron Man where you sit down and just go, every effect was a winner. I loved it.
But I just think it's humiliating when you see other films that are like not good and you think, well, if these guys could pull this off with technology of what they had 30 years ago, with today's technology, you just owe it to yourself to get better.
Definitely.
Do better.
It's but you're right. We had that cycle with digital effects, didn't we? It was like we started putting digital effects in, then we started seeing the holes in them again. And we were like, well, how come they can't make them like we did for Close Encounters?
I mean, it comes down to discipline in the end. You have to be pretty disciplined in designing the shot so it will work.
Yep.
And not just saying, well, we can fly any which way we want and go anywhere we want and do anything we want. Yeah, you can, but you compromise when you do that, I think. There were some very funny aspects watching this film again, and I never noticed them the first time. I mean, just stupid little things like when they were in that stupid glass trailer and they're rolling in the giant map. And there's almost no room, you know, the big atlas, globe thing. There's almost no room. And why don't they just stand outside the big glass bloody thing and look at it? But they lug it up in there so they can all sort of crowd around in.
And the guys in the red suits.
Yeah.
Remember seeing those guys? They're very rigid and formal and they're marching in their line. And they're the ones who they're going to put on the spaceship. And then Richard Dreyfuss joins them at the end. And obviously Richard Dreyfuss gets picked to go inside the spaceship and all the other poor little men in red suits that have been made to look silly don't get to fly with a big spaceship.
I remember that all the guys went in the spaceship. Is it only Richard Dreyfuss that goes up in the spaceship?
I think it's only... Actually, you know, you're right. I think I watched the director's cut and just he goes in. But I think I do remember seeing an earlier version where everyone gets to go in.
Everybody gets to go. He was just one of the guys that went.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Because the aliens come out and take him by the hand and lead him in first.
Yep.
And then I thought other aliens went and grabbed the other people and dragged them in as well.
It's very confusing with all these versions.
It is very confusing, yes.
And
it was very confusing
film.
That they said that Devil's Tower was actually at 104, 44, 30, 40, 36, 10, when obviously it isn't. It's about 300 miles away from that location if you actually look it up on Google Maps. So it's very upset about, actually. It's closer to, like, Stage Colorado. East, I don't know. Anyway, sorry.
I'll keep that in mind next time I'm
very upset. Well, you know, all I can say is thank you, Matt, for joining us.
Thank you for encouraging me to go back and look at a great film.
And to quote my favourite line, Einstein was right. Einstein was probably one of them.
You see, my favourite line was, after this, can we throw more dirt in my window?
Until next time, guys. Thanks so much. And thanks especially to Christian Martin, who's our producer and editor and who puts the shows together. If you want to get more information about upcoming shows or stuff, check out our new website, which is www.vfxshow.com, or go over to PixelCore at pixelcore.tv. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. Thanks so much.
And I'm Matt Graham. Thank you.